Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Columbus ranks 16th in the country with almost 28,000 call center workers. Legislation is being introduced in Congress to protect their jobs and the security of consumer information. The Ohio News Network's Jay Fox talks with Ohio's Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown about the United States Call Center Worker and Consumer Protection Act. And there's a series of fundraising events about to start in the Columbus area that will be a big hit with lovers of local beer. We'll learn more about the Summer of Brews and Wishes, benefiting the Special Wish Foundation of Central Ohio. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, here's Jay Fox.
We're talking with senior Ohio U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown. Call centers have provided employment for many Ohioans. Columbus, in fact, ranks 16th in the country with almost 28,000 call center workers. Nationwide, that number is 2.9 million. Senator, you've introduced the U.S. Call Center Worker and Consumer Protection Act as potential legislation. Why is this so important?
Well, we're seeing with call centers what we saw in every community in the state. Where I grew up in Mansfield, I went to Johnny Appleseed Junior High School with the sons and daughters of machinists and electricians and millwrights and auto workers and steel workers. And those jobs, because corporations lobbied Congress and because politicians of both parties sold out our communities, in my mind, many of those jobs went overseas. I don't want to see the same thing happening with call centers. It's also a protection. It's also an issue of protection of privacy and freedom and protecting our national security. So keep these jobs here. Government shouldn't be putting its thumb on the scale so that these companies move overseas by getting various kinds of grants and loans. None of those jobs, whenever there's federal dollars, none of those jobs should be allowed to go overseas.
So when we talk about companies that impact this situation, they range across a broad variety of industries. For example, in Columbus, JP Morgan Chase, Nationwide Insurance, Verizon, Amazon. What specific penalties can be introduced to prevent them from making that choice to outsource or send these call centers overseas?
Well, first of all, these federal grants, loans, any federal dollars that go to any of these companies, they should not be eligible for this if they're moving their jobs overseas. So if it's federal dollars involved, do it in America, make it in America. That's something we should have been following for generations. And as I say, often presidents of both parties sold us out on those issues. And corporate interest lobbying Congress did the same thing. I also want people to, if they're overseas and they answer the phone in a call center, they should identify where they are and give the customer the ability to be transferred to a call center in the United States.
Now, let's say that somebody moves a call center operation outside of the United States. Do these companies like Nationwide, Verizon, Amazon, et cetera, do they have to report that they're doing this, or how do we know?
Yeah, they should report. They should be required under this bill to report that they have moved their call center overseas. Any federal dollars they're getting for any kind of federal grants, loans, contracts, they should lose if they move these overseas. This is a movie we've seen before. We've seen what's happened in urban, small town, even rural Ohio, where companies have moved overseas. Partly corporate greed, partly Congress and presidents of both parties made it easier for them to move overseas. And it's really the reason we've lost a big part of the middle class in the last 40 years.
How strong is the Communication Workers of America Union? How active were they in supporting this particular piece of legislation?
Well, I think the union movement's stronger today than it's been in generations. Young people are more pro-union than they've been in my lifetime. And they've spoken out on this. They and others have educated me and members of Congress on what exactly is happening in sort of the call center world. Isn't a lot of expertise among members of Congress on this issue. It's happening. The CWA, of course, supports the bill. And we've worked with them and others on making sure that American jobs are protected.
Now, you did say earlier that American consumers are also affected and that this legislation will protect consumers' personal data. Should we be concerned about talking to foreigners about our accounts?
Well, it's about the freedom to choose. To me, it's about protecting people's personal data, whether it's from foreigners or from American corporations or from the American government. And again, we see in comparison to this, what's happened with electric vehicles. China is trying to sell all these electric vehicles into the United States. These electric vehicles are able to, because of very advanced technology in China, able to gather people's personal data. They're a threat to national security. So I want to make sure that just like with electric vehicles, I've told the administration you should ban these electric vehicles and the Chinese electric vehicles in the United States because of personal data, personal privacy, because of national security, and because of jobs. I see call centers in some ways and in some aspects the same way.
Now, Intel has made a choice to put their semiconductor manufacturing in the central Ohio region. Is this something that perhaps could be contagious and other companies would choose to stay in the United States, in Ohio, in central Ohio, for that reason?
Well, Congress, for the first time, has created an industrial policy, something I've advocated for pretty much my whole career in public office. And finally, we're doing that, but with an industrial policy. We need trade enforcement. We need it. When Nippon tries to buy U.S. steel, we need it. When Chinese solar industry is dumping their solar products into the United States, jeopardizing thousands of jobs in one company, Northwest Ohio, the largest solar manufacturer in America is First Solar in Northwest Ohio. So this is all a whole policy to reshore the supply chains. We know one of the big reasons for inflation, it's corporate greed, for sure. You go to the grocery store, you pay more because of stock buybacks. It's also because we've allowed, again, presidents in both parties, from Bush all the way to Biden, including Trump and Obama, and all of them have sold us out on trade policy. And we've seen that we have lost far too many jobs. And that's a big part of what caused inflation, these supply chains from all over the world, instead of holding it closer to home.
We've been talking with senior Ohio U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown. We thank you so much for your time.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett, joined today by Pam Spring. She is the event and volunteer coordinator for a Special Wish Foundation of Central Ohio. And they have some great activities coming up this summer, especially if you like local beer. Hi, Pam. Thanks for joining us on Columbus Perspective.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, coming up on Sunday, June 2nd, is the first of a series of events that you're calling the Summer of Brews for Wishes. Pam, what is this event?
Well, we enlisted the help of local breweries. And honestly, breweries are kind of in a tough spot right now since COVID. They've been struggling a little bit. So our goal, basically, was 10 breweries, and we thought that was maybe a little lofty. We ended up with 15 donor/sponsor breweries. And our four sponsor breweries are Edison in Gahanna, Combustion in Pickerington, Homestead in Canal Winchester, and Fatty's in Westerville. We are having events at those four locations, so we consider them sponsoring breweries. Some breweries are donating a percent of sales. Combustion donated their event space, 3 hours of event space time, which is a $600 donation. So they've all done different things, but we are having events, larger events at those four places with music, silent auctions, raffles, food trucks, et cetera. And one of the big things we're doing throughout this summer is we're raffling off a brew wagon, which will have around $1,200 or $1,300 worth of swag from 15 different breweries. In August, we will load it up with beer from 12 of those breweries, and the three that aren't won't be represented don't can their beer. So it's kind of hard to put that beer in the brew wagon. But so that's going to be a big thing. We're going to sell a deck of cards at each of those four events. So it'll be a 1 in 208 chance of winning that brew wagon.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And it's kind of a smaller field of competitors that you're against in that raffle. So your odds are pretty decent.
Right. They are. And, you know, we've got some Parsons North donated a tour and tasting for 12 people, which is $240 value. Crooked Cannon Hilliard donated a basket worth $192 with a ton of swag and then a $50 gift card. World of Beer, which won't be able to donate beer, but they donated a really nice basket of swag for the Brew Wagon. So I think the Brew Wagon's going to be a hit. It'll be a great thing for people who tailgate, you know, down the road in the fall and everything. So that's one of the bigger things that we're doing along with the events.
One thing about local breweries that I have found, and I'm so sorry to hear, you know, that even this far past the big lockdown from COVID, it's still a struggle, but I know it is for so many. What I was going to say, though, is a lot of times at these local breweries, it's not just a bar. You know, first of all, they usually call it a tasting room or whatever, but the vibe and the environment are, I find, a little more family friendly. I find a lot of my friends with little ones will easily pack them up in the stroller and bring them along so mom and dad can enjoy a local brew, and the kids aren't home with a sitter. And I would imagine for your upcoming events, that's the same situation. Are these adults only, or is this for the whole family?
Oh, it's open to the whole family. We will be represented. We will have a representative Wish family at each event.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of these breweries also welcome pets on their patios. They're pet friendly as well. So, come out, bring the whole family, enjoy the music. The first event at Edison is Sunday, June 2nd, like you said, from 3 to 6 p.m. We have the Funky Waters Band, which is soul R&B. Genre, and they have donated their time. The food truck is Valley Verde, which is, I think, Mexican. So that will be there that day. Like I said, along with the raffles and the silent auctions and all the things that go along with a nonprofit event. So we're looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And I love that you're including a Wish family at each event. It's always so important, I think, for those who are participating in fundraising to really know where that money's going, and for a special Wish Foundation of Central Ohio. Pam, tell us a little bit more about what it is that your organization does.
Okay. We have been dedicated for 42 years now to granting the special wish of children who are battling a life-threatening illness. And the thing that's different about a special wish is our age range. We're the only wish granting organization in the country that has the age range that we have, which is birth through and including the age of 20. And other wish granting organizations, the child is usually around three, they need to verbalize their wish. So that's usually around three through and including 17. So we have that wider age range that other wish granting organizations do not. We are local pretty much in Ohio. We do have a outlier chapter in the Chicago area, but we have the four corners in the center of the state, and we've granted since 1982, our inception, we've granted, you know, over 4,000 wishes. The child has to be in the age range that we talked about through and including age 20, have a life-threatening illness, which their specialist verifies, and I never had a wish from another wish granting organization before. That's the three criteria for a wish. And our founder, Ramona Fickle, we lost her in September of 2022 at the age of 92, but she had five healthy children, and she was a hospice volunteer at the time. And Make-A-Wish had just started the year before, and she'd seen something on the news. So when she looked into it and found that there was absolutely nothing in Ohio to service these children, she started a special wish foundation.
Oh my goodness.
Of our history.
I had no idea. That is fascinating. Now,
she lived in Canal Winchester the whole life of the organization.
Oh my goodness. Pam Spring is with us today. She's the event and volunteer coordinator for a Special Wish Foundation of Central Ohio. It's their Summer of Brews for Wishes with the first of a series of events coming up on Sunday, June 2nd at, it's the Edison Brewery, right, Pam?
Yeah, it's in Gahanna.
Okay.
Right off of Taylor Station Road and not far off of 270.
Okay. And where can one go for more information about this and the subsequent events?
For the most detailed information, if they would go to our website, aspecialwishfoundation.org, or our Facebook page, A Special Wish Central Ohio, they would give more detailed information on the Summer Brews for Wishes campaign and each of the four events.
And the dates for the other events, those have been set, right?
We have Combustion Brewery in Pickerington is Thursday, July 25th. The Silver Band will be playing, and they haven't announced their food truck yet, but the Silver Band will be playing. It'll be upstairs in their event room there from 6 to 9. And then on Sunday, August 4th, we'll be at Fatty's in Westerville, and that's going to be a 3 to 6 on a Sunday afternoon. That is Dwight Young will be playing music there. It's a smaller brewery, so we couldn't have a band, but we do have music, live music. And then the final event to wrap up the campaign is Saturday, August 24th at Homestead in Canal Winchester. And the band is Reeling in the Years. They're a big local Canal Winchester band around there. And the neat thing about Homestead is they sit next to a green space in Canal Winchester, and Dora is in effect there.
Very
so people
cool.
Can take beer from Homestead and go out on the green with it. In fact, the band is actually setting up in the gazebo on the green.
Very cool.
So I think that last event's going to be our biggest one, probably.
Looking forward to all of them. I don't know about anyone else, but I have some serious plans already made for most of the summer now. This sounds like fun.
Well, great.
I'm so grateful that you wanted to spend this time with us today on Columbus Perspective, and wish you the best of luck with the Summer of Brews for Wishes to benefit A Special Wish Foundation of Central Ohio.
Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
The city of Columbus is growing. To keep up with the population growth, the city is proposing a major update to its zoning code. Here's the thing. The city's zoning code hasn't been updated for 70 years. The city estimates it will need 200,000 new housing units in the next decade just to keep up with demand. But Mayor Andrew Ginther says the current zoning codes will make that difficult to achieve. The city is looking to create new codes that would allow for the development of taller, mixed-use buildings on the main streets of city neighborhoods in a more streamlined process. Updating the code would allow for the creation of 88,000 new homes in the targeted areas versus 6,000 new homes with the way the code is currently written, according to the city. Developers will be able to build even taller if they promise to allocate 20 to 30% of the properties to affordable housing. And now is the time for the public to weigh in. The city is in the 60-day period for public comment. It runs through June 10th. Joining me now to talk about the City of Columbus's Zone In initiative is City Council President Pro Tem Rob Dorans. He is also the Zoning Committee Chair. Councilman Dorans, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
First of all, just why did it take 70 years for the city to take a look at the zoning code?
I think it's a great question. And I think when you look at how complicated zoning is, when you talk about land use policy, you can get in the weeds very, very quickly. You know, this is not an easy subject for anyone to really to dig into and think about what are the intended and unintended consequences of how that code translates out to housing or other development issues within the city. But I think right now, the reason that we're taking this up right now is just that demand for housing that we're seeing. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about rentals or owner-occupied. We can see over the past 10-plus years that housing prices have just increased rapidly. And that's translated now to folks having more and more housing instability in our communities. So when you say why now, it's we really don't have a choice. When we think about the growth that Columbus experienced and is it going to experience in the future, we need to try to do something differently to help to streamline that process to bring more housing online sooner than later.
I mean, when you hear 200,000 new homes needed in the next decade, That's really eye-opening.
It is, and I think, you know, that's all kinds of housing. You know, we're talking about apartments, we're talking about condos, we're talking about duplexes, we're talking about the whole continuum of housing, right? But when you think about what this means to families, you know, if a community really means that when we say housing is a human right, that we want our friends and family to be able to have an affordable place to call home, we need to make sure that we're tackling this. Because right now, when you talk about that change of currently what is proposed in this first phase of Zone In, while that's only 4% of the city, so most of the city is not touched by this first phase. But we're talking about going from the potential of 6,000 new housing units close to 90,000. That's a tremendous difference when we talk about how does our land use policy be very intentional about trying to encourage new things like new housing across our city.
So what is it about the zoning proposal that would take it from 6,000 that you could build to 88,000? What's the change?
One of the most basic things is that most of these parcels right now are zoned completely commercial. So when you go back and think about how we approached land use 70 years ago, it was more about suburban sprawl, right? It was more of 1950s mindset of commercial needs to stay away from residential. So when we think about how do we make some of these changes, when you talk about that mixed use aspect to it, most of these properties right now, again, are zoned commercial, and you'd have to come to get a rezoning or a variance from us to do any residential. And that adds 6 to 18 months typically on any development process, which leads to higher costs for that housing provider, which then translates out to higher costs for whether those are owner-occupied or rentals, right? So the first things first is that all these six new zoning districts that we've created will allow both commercial and residential to live together. And I think when you look at areas of the city, older areas of the city that developed even before zoning, so before the 1950s, you see that, where you see, commercial and residential living in harmony. You know, you can places in German Village, Near East Side, Short North, where you can walk to, you know, do your banking, you can get your haircut, you can go to the grocery store, all within the same few blocks. And that changed when we started putting these very restrictive aspects to our code in, saying we want to keep people apart, we want to keep uses apart. Mm-hmm. I think the approach with this code is saying we actually want to bring communities together and actually have more connected neighborhoods with these zoning districts.
And is the key building up? Rather than out. I mean,
right. So again, when you talk about what that 1950s mindset was, it was about sprawl, right? It was about building out where we're going to sort of sprawl across the community. I think most folks don't realize that Columbus's square mileage is about the same as the city of Chicago. So again, they're about 8 or 9 million people. We're a little less than a million people. So you think about how sprawled out we are. You know, the only way for us to really to meet this housing demand in a more equitable way is to better utilize our land that's closer to transit, that's closer to job centers, in order to bring those housing units where we need them. And that's a much better way for us to approach this when we think about things like Link Us with CODA that's going to bring more high-frequency, reliable mass transit to portions of the city that have not had that in a very long time. And that's a way for us to lower housing costs, too, because land's not getting cheaper, certainly anytime soon. And when you think about just the most basic level of increase in density, you know, I lived in Italian Village for about 10 years, and I lived in a duplex. It's illegal to build a duplex like that now with our current zoning code. And when you think about that, that piece of land had two families on it living in that house versus just one family. So you're talking about just a little bit more density on that parcel, which makes it more productive, which allows, again, more folks to be able to call that area home. So when we talk about building up, the code itself, we're talking about potentially going to places that you can build more to up to 4 stories or going up to potentially 12 stories or more with more affordable housing. But that is a way specifically for us to lower housing costs generally by allowing more housing on those pieces of property, but also allow the more housing in the places that we know that the public infrastructure is there that can support it and where we know we're going to provide additional investments in the future.
And one of the things about the current code is that neighborhoods have a height cap at 35 feet.
Yeah.
So is that part of the proposal to change that to be able to go up?
Yeah, it is. So it's when you hear 35 feet, it may be a little bit difficult for some viewers to really conceptualize what that
two
is.
Two stories,
right? Yeah. That's the height limit for most houses in Columbus, right? And we think about doesn't take long to drive up High Street or East Broad or down Main and see plenty of buildings that are above that two-story limit. But every single one of those buildings typically had to come to Columbus City Council to get a variance, whether or not they were going 1 inch up or 100 feet up. Right. So for us, these zoning districts will allow folks to build up higher, but they're very customized. Right. So there's 6 different districts. And on top of that, they're also customized to the areas that they're located in. So, you know, for example, there's areas of the city that along these main corridors where it's, you know, buttoned up to more single family neighborhoods. Well, those proposed changes are more looking like that 4-story. So we're going to increase density just a little bit, whereas there's areas near campus other places around the city that already have, you know, 5, 6, 10-story buildings, yeah, that's where we propose basically for folks to be able to go up a little bit higher based on knowing that the development patterns today have already supported that. And again, the infrastructure is there to support that growth right now.
And one of the concerns that we have heard is that with the zoning code, though, there might be like cutting back on the amount of parking that's required. Mm-hmm. Is that the case? And what's being done about that?
It is. So the proposal that council is considering right now does eliminate parking minimums on these parcels that are in phase one. Again, we're talking about a little over 12,000 parcels in this first phase. So most of the city is not touched by this first phase of the zoning initiative. But parking minimums are eliminated. What I can tell you, folks, is there's a lot of, you know, hey, the sky is falling. I'm never going to be able to park my car anywhere.
It is a challenge right now in parts of town.
It certainly is. But I think when you look at places like downtown where we eliminated a parking minimum 20 years ago, those new residential developments still include parking. We're eliminating this arbitrary number that's been under code for decades, 1.5 spots per unit. And I think when you go out and look at new developments, so many of them come to us at City Council for almost every single one asking for a parking variance. So right now, most folks are not complying with that requirement right now because they're coming to get a variance from us because they're having to right-size their parking. We are generally overparked with a lot of these new developments, particularly if you go to some of our affordable housing partners. They come get a variance from us, and half their parking lot's still empty. So for me, anyways, what we're thinking about is how do we have a market-driven approach where folks that know what their development needs can actually propose, you know, that rather than having some arbitrary number sort of drive that. And for me, anyways, it's more about prioritizing people over parking, right? Most folks don't realize the cost of parking. If you're talking about a surface spot, you're talking about several thousand dollars probably for that individual spot to be constructed. And if you're talking about structured parking, you're talking about tens of thousands of dollars to build that parking spot. So let's make sure we're right-sizing parking and, again, prioritizing more housing. We're prioritizing people over just a parking spot.
And you also touched on it a little bit, too, with the transportation focus, too, to bring in public transportation more for to kind of take that place, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, we want to move towards a place where folks can, you know, use their cars, can use parking as a, you know, normal part of their days. But at the same time, you know, Central Ohio has not had the mass transit infrastructure that it desperately needs. And that's when you look at where the zoning corridors are. These are areas that have good, for the most part, COTA service today, so good bus service. And we know with the Link Us initiative that's on the ballot here in November that I'm hoping voters will support, that will allow the biggest investment into public transit in Central Ohio's history. We're talking about the creation of a number of bus rapid transit lines, which if folks have not seen these, it's sort of light rail on wheels, right? So we're actually going to be able to bring for the first time these massive investments to mass transit in Columbus that we haven't had before to give people options in these areas.
We only have about a minute left. I want to touch on how people can weigh in right now. There's the Zone-In Gallery downtown on Front Street. What does that offer?
Yeah, it's basically a see, feel, and touch kind of place, right? So you can actually see what the new code would allow to be created in some of these districts, what the old code actually required, which, you know, actually visualizing this when you're talking about zoning is sometimes difficult. So that is a really key way to be able to visually see what this new code is going to mean for your neighborhood.
And we're also looking right now at video of the Zone-In website. What information can people find, and what can they do on that website?
Yeah, so two things. This is probably the best place to go to find information about what may be potentially affecting your neighborhood. You can zoom all the way down into individual parcels and see what the changes that have been proposed for that area are. You can see what a visual representation of what that might look like in the future. And then also, most importantly, that is the best place to leave a comment. You like it, you don't like it, you got a question. It's a very easy, user-friendly way, basically, to leave a comment, ask a question, and that's going to be inserted in our database for council to consider.
Council President Pro Tem Rob Dorrance, thank you so much for your time and laying out what the city is trying to do here.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the time.
And so, to give your opinion or learn more about the zoning update, we just talked about it. You can go to the Zone-In Gallery on North Front Street 6 days a week. The schedule is on the Zone-In website at columbus.gov/zoningupdate. You'll also find code materials and an interactive map that accepts residents' comments. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way and call 614-845-5343. The comment period, again, runs through June 10th.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10 TV.
Ohio lawmakers announced Braden's Law. The proposed bill has one purpose, to stop the online crime of sextortion. The FBI says it's the fastest growing crime in the country, and it's leading to many suicides of young teens. This proposed law is named after Braden Marcus, a 15-year-old freshman from Olentangy High School who took his own life after an online exchange. Since then, his mother has been on a quest to hold those online predators accountable. 10 TV's Angela Ann has followed Braden's story from the very beginning. She recently sat down with Braden's mom. Angela found that Jennifer Marcus is more than a mom on a mission. She's a mother who is turning her grief into action.
It's memories of him. It's what he did. It's what he loved. Every baseball bat since he started his career.
This is where Jennifer Marcus goes to be close to her son, Braden.
Come say hi down here. Look at his pictures. I call it the Braden Shrine.
Her laughter masks the anguish buried deep.
Mm-hmm. Why the kid that always was smiling, got along with everybody? Why did you target him?
Every day since October 17th, 2021, Jennifer has tried to fill the void of losing her son to a scammer who convinced Braden to send a nude photo and then tried to extort money. In that 27-minute exchange, Braden begged, "Please don't," he said. "I'm killing myself. Please."
Well, I think going back to essentially somebody came into our house and, in my eyes, murdered my kid in front of the whole world, they should have to pay some time and pay the crime.
Which is where friend Rachel Winder comes in.
There is a law in the books for extortion. There's a law in the books for illegally disseminating image of a minor. There's little things that prosecutors could piece together if they had to, but this is a new crime.
She helped craft what Braden's family hopes will soon become an Ohio law.
It creates the crime of sextortion, so the perpetrator will go away forever.
Something else Braden's law would do: force companies to give parents of deceased minors digital access within 30 days.
It took us literally 10 months to figure it out, to get into that phone. And no parent in this world should ever have to wait more than a day when they had the code at their fingertips. After losing a child and not knowing what happened, the kid goes from having the weekend of their life, playing football, working on a driver's ed test, to not being here. It's like he vanished. There's a reason.
Back in Braden's shrine.
This is Braden's senior football banner that they put up and displayed in the stadium all year.
Jennifer is grateful the school and Braden's friends made sure his memory was part of every milestone. She hopes Braden's law will be one more moment to dull the never-ending pain.
I think it just hit us a couple weeks ago as everybody's graduation cards are coming in. He's not graduating. So it's been a living hell.
Well, it's been a living hell. Mm-hmm. That kind of sums it up. Angela joins me now. Angela, you were there for the big introduction.
Yes.
Of Braden's Law. You know, what was it like? The family was there and so many supporters.
You know, it was actually like a big exhale. I think the family has been fighting so long to do something since 2021 when Braden took his life. They knew they needed some kind of law on the books. A lot of people don't realize, Doug, but sextortion at the time, and still is, it's a misdemeanor. So this law would make it a felony in the first, second, third degree with prison time. And that's so critical because the mom just feels like her son needs justice. You know, Braden's perpetrators need to pay the time for the crime. So I think the press conference, the announcement of Braden's Law, finally here, a proposal, it's just the beginning. They got to get it mm-hmm. through. They got to get it to the governor's desk and get it signed.
And there's a third component that Marcus... Braden's mom wants
mm-hmm.
in this.
Yes, and they talked about it at this press conference where, along with the digital access within 30 days, not 10 months that they had to wait, along with making it a felony, and you see her hugging her daughter Ella here, so many people don't realize the toll it takes on a family. This was a violent crime, but sextortion is not categorized under victim crime compensation in the state. So most of the time, if you are compensated for loss of wages or having to clean up a crime scene, whatever, that's all taken care of. It's all, you know, they get the money back eventually. For this, They didn't. They got denied, actually. And so the mom says we need to be classified as part of the victim's crime compensation because their family has gone through so much. You know, they've lost time and wages with their jobs. And so that's so important for them.
Angela Ann, great coverage. It was very powerful.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate being here.
And thank you for being here. Now, if you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts or are in crisis, you can reach out to the Crisis Lifeline by dialing 988. Help is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Parenting is hard. Technology can make it harder. The Family Media Plan developed by the American Academy of Pediatrics helps make it easier. Go to healthychildren.org/media plan to create the media plan that's right for your family. Whether you make a full plan or just choose a few parts that matter the most to your family, healthychildren.org/media plan is an easy-to-use tool that will help your family set media priorities and create healthy digital habits in line with your family's values. You'll also get practical tips to help make the plan work. And you can come back to revise your plan as often as you need to, like at the beginning of each school year or during summer and holiday breaks. Raising kids in the age of screens is easier when you have a plan. Go to healthychildren.org/media plan and make your plan today.
Speaking of protecting kids from the threats of technology, Governor Mike DeWine signed a bill into law to limit cell phone use by students in public schools. He held the signing ceremony at a Dublin middle school. Dublin City Schools put a cell phone policy in place this school year. Now, schools across the state will have to implement similar policies. With the stroke of many pens, Governor DeWine signed the Cell Phones in Schools bill into law, surrounded by state leaders and students at Carr Middle School in Dublin. The bill requires public schools to create a policy limiting phone use as much as possible during school hours. It also requires the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce to create a model policy for schools to adopt if they don't want to make their own.
And what we hope is the vast, vast majority of schools will make a decision that cell phones in schools are what we know, and that is counterproductive to learning.
Educators around the state say banning phones in their schools led to greater student engagement, fewer skipped classes, and less bullying. Carr Middle School principal Brooke Manduni has seen the same in her building.
It's been monumental. The engagement that students have with not only one another but within the school building has been one of the biggest difference makers in my career.
Then there's the noise in the hallways and cafeteria.
The noise level in the lunchroom is much louder, but it's a good loud. They're interacting, they're laughing.
Just weeks ago, Governor DeWine advocated for the bill in his State of the State address. Now it's already law.
This happened this fast because there is a broad consensus today that cell phones in schools are not good.
Principal Manduni is very glad her district took the lead on this issue.
It's not to say after schools they're not still back on cell phones and devices, but teachers are able to teach, students are able to learn, and we feel like a community again.
A modern day update for a Columbus landmark that dates way back to 1886. Two major additions to the Ohio Expo Center and State Fairgrounds in about 2 years. Governor Mike DeWine joined others to break ground on a major part of the Expo 2050 Master Plan. The governor said the vision is to build on the greatness of Ohio's agriculture and bring more people in to see what Ohio is all about. The project is making way for progress while holding on to the history and character of the fairgrounds. One well-known Ohio company has been part of this history for more than a century.
They are assembling roast beef sandwiches.
A mural outside the Schmitz restaurant office at the State Fairgrounds shows generations of Schmitz serving their classic food at the Ohio State Fair. Chief Operating Officer Carla Epler says they've been here since 1914.
It means everything. We are all about legacy, tradition, culture, and this is the meshing of it. We're kind of back to our roots.
She watched as Governor Mike DeWine and the fairgrounds team broke ground on two major new buildings that will grace the land that's hosted the state fair since 1886.
When we're finished, the fair will be even more fantastic showcase for Ohio while continuing to celebrate the state's deep agricultural roots.
Renderings show the new agriculture building. It will have a Taste of Ohio cafe and feature agricultural and other exhibits in more than 100,000 square feet of space. The new Ohio Showcase building will have exhibits on Ohio's people, communities, and innovation, as well as six restaurants offering regional Ohio dishes. Ohio Future Farmers of America President Anna Moeller recently went to the FFA State Convention at the Ohio Expo Center and talked about the mixed emotions that come with change.
Some of our representatives here talk about this today, but it can be a very bittersweet thing just because there are so many memories made on these state fairgrounds and everything. But it's also very important that we continue to progress throughout our time and everything, and I think that these changes will be very beneficial.
Epler agrees on the bittersweetness of the evolution of the fairgrounds.
We were actually in a meeting when the Ohio building came down, and it was kind of like, oh my gosh, but it's so exciting to be part of setting the future.
Perhaps a feeling shared by the governor and first lady, holding a piece of history.
By the way, that archway you saw there on the old agriculture and horticulture building will be preserved. The new construction projects are expected to be finished by the 2026 state fair, so there will be some fenced off areas for this year's fair, which runs July 24th through August 4th. Along with the two projects we just talked about, several other major ones are going on for a total cost of $456 million.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.